Today, during CAP Radio special coverage, conversations about race.
He felt a lot of shame in feeling Asian American, and I think that he's spent a good part of his life trying not to feel ashamed.
CAP Radio's immigration and communities of color reporter Sarah Mises-Tan talking about her dad, how this ties into the Black Lives Matter movement and a concept known as racial triangulation. I'm Randall White. Join us just after the news. This is CAP Radio's special coverage. I'm Randall White. The past few weeks have seen a growing number of conversations about race, all in the wake of the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis and several other people of color before and after that incident. These conversations are not always comfortable and don't always have a resolution, but they do, hopefully, expand our understanding of what others are feeling and going through. Here at CAP Radio, our immigration and communities of color reporter, Sarah Mises-Tan, has been busy chronicling this and took a moment to discuss her personal connection to the issue with our partner station, KQED in San Francisco, for their podcast called The Bay. Here is that conversation in its entirety, and we'll follow up with our own discussion with Sarah right after we listen to this.
From KQED.
Reporter Sarah Mises-Tan has been thinking a lot about her dad lately. He's an Asian immigrant who came to the United States from Singapore as a kid. And growing up, her dad experienced racism and always encouraged her to stand up to it. Which is why after the death of George Floyd and the protests for Black Lives, Sarah knew the racism her dad experienced and the racism Black people experience are connected struggles.
This was something that he'd been fighting for his entire life, and this was finally happening. I think that in a lot of ways, his beliefs and views that I've seen my whole life with him really very much align with what's happening with Black Lives Matter.
But Asian Americans are approaching their role in the Black Lives Matter movement from a lot of different places, as immigrants, refugees, first-generation college students, and Asian Americans who've been here for generations. It's a group with its own history of racism in the United States. Today, how the Black Lives Matter movement to dismantle white supremacy is a relatable fight. I'm Devin Katayama. Welcome to The Bay.
My dad came to New York in the mid-60s with his family. They moved to Queens, and he was about six when they came, and they've lived on the East Coast ever since.
Sarah Mises-Tan is a reporter with Capital Public Radio covering race and communities of color in Sacramento. And she's been exploring the different ways from which Asian Americans are approaching the Black Lives Matter movement.
I think that he just grew up in the 60s during a time that was very formative in his life. I think that 1960s America in Queens, in New York, I think he felt a lot of shame in feeling Asian American. And I think that he's spent a good part of his life trying not to feel ashamed of being an Asian American and unliving a lot of the experiences with racism that he experienced when he was in middle school and high school. I very much grew up in the tradition of watching him stand up against what he believed was racism against Asian people and watching him get rebuffed by the system again and again. We grew up in a predominantly white neighborhood in New York. And that was very formative for me to see just where it is that Asians stood in this discourse and to see that a lot of people didn't really want to hear what he had to say.
Let's talk a little bit about how you approach this, because the word Asian is so broad. It doesn't do the different ethnicities justice, you know, within the Asian race. So how did you personally approach this question, this topic?
Yeah, I decided to go back to my dad, who I think has been a source of a lot of the forming of my ideas in Asian American in this country. So I went back to him and kind of asked him. I had been surprised that despite his stance on race and what I have seen as his stance on race, that he was actually feeling somewhat ambivalent about supporting the Black Lives Matter movement also.
What were those conversations like?
They were really interesting.
What are the feelings that you feel right now that are keeping you from supporting the Black Lives Matter movement right now?
He mentions a lot of times in which he had personal interactions that would be racist with African Americans.
It just makes me feel awful. It still does. It still hurts, just like, I'm sure racism hurts African Americans when they experience it, and it hurts me too. And it's not just a hurt, it's the deep kind of pain that I experience.
I also think that it was somewhat difficult for him to take those experiences and also see that there was a more systemic reason behind why Asian Americans should be supporting Black Lives Matter.
So the sense that I'm getting is, you know, you generally feel like there's a certain amount of racism perpetuated by African Americans against Asian people. Is that the biggest point that's kind of your hurdle in terms of getting behind the movement?
Yes, that is. That most definitely is. I think that has to be addressed, and it has to be addressed, you know, just as with the racism against African Americans has lasted too long and it has to be addressed now. Why should it be more of a part of the Black Lives Matter demonstrations when I've been completely overlooked, basically?
He sees race relations as something that is very personal and one-on-one, and those are the memories that stick with him.
Sarah, so you spoke with some professors about the complicated positions from which Asian Americans are approaching the Black Lives Matter movement. What did they have to say about the conversations Asian Americans are having with their parents right now, like the ones you've been having with your dad?
Yeah, I think overall, my dad's biggest concern with the Black Lives Matter movement is that he worried that change would only happen for Black people out of it. He worried that the experiences that Asian Americans had with race and continue to have with race and racism were just going to continue to be perpetuated. And we would see equality for Black people, but people would continue to ignore Asian Americans and whatever particular interactions we have with the system also. But I think that after speaking with a lot of these professors, I think that that is a pessimistic way to look at it.
You can face racism from African Americans as an Asian American, but you could still be Black Lives Matter supporting. Both can be equally true.
I spoke with Russell Jong at SF State. He's a professor there and the head of the Asian American Studies Department. And he mentioned the difficulty in Asian Americans distinguishing the difference between personal interactions with individual African American people and the types of interactions that come out of there versus a larger system that's in place.
And so I think we have to distinguish between individual and systemic discrimination, and both the Black Lives Matter movement and our Stop API Hate movement is trying to dismantle the systemic structures that are sort of the foundation of racism.
He felt that if you were doing work that was trying to dismantle the system of white supremacy at all, that was something that was in support of this. And I thought that really shifted the way that I could see my dad participating in it.
My recommendation to Asian Americans is to link the racial profiling that Asian Americans are experiencing now during the pandemic to how other groups are being racially profiled. We're not trying to play the oppression Olympics, but we're trying to develop empathy that this racial profiling process occurs to a lot of groups and hurts a lot of groups. And what we need to do is work together to stop that racial profiling.
There's a long history of racism against Asian people in this country, and there's also the model minority myth, as you mentioned, that says Asians as a group have overcome oppression to be successful, which we know is a harmful generalization. How do you think that plays into some people's understanding of Asian and Black relationships?
I actually think Nancy kind of touches on this.
I think most folks in our communities are still pro-law enforcement.
Nancy Zhang with Hmong Innovating Politics, she touches on the fact that a lot of Hmong think that once they join law enforcement, they've kind of reached the top, the peak, they've assimilated fully. And she said, but they don't understand that they're not white either, they're Asian. Like, these people don't care about them either. And I think there's that reckoning that maybe a lot of Asian people have to get their heads around.
It really feeds into like the model minority that, you know, like Asians, you know, are good, you know, they're good listeners, they don't cause any trouble, and they're complicit, right, in the death of George Floyd.
Tu Tao is the police officer in Minneapolis who's seen in aiding Derek Chauvin as Chauvin kneels for 8 minutes and 46 seconds on the neck of George Floyd. And it's a really, the whole scene is distressing. I think as an Asian person watching this video, you immediately notice that he's Asian and you kind of have a moment where you say, oh no, I'm not that. I don't want to be that. And then you wonder, are you that?
Charges have now been filed against all four police officers involved in George Floyd's death. The charge against Derek.
We do have a history of also being policed by the cops.
She mentioned that the Hmong population is one that doesn't necessarily fall within the model minority stereotype for Asians. They're mostly refugees. They don't necessarily come from any particular country. And a lot of them have inhabited the very same neighborhoods that other low-income minorities have inhabited. In Sacramento here, they share a neighborhood where Stephon Clark, who was Sacramento's most recent police killing, they share that neighborhood, which is Meadowview. It's in South Sacramento, and it's almost very evenly split between African Americans, Latinos, and Asians, mostly Hmong.
You know, after I was born in 1990, like, I just remember cops harassing my brothers, right, a lot, my cousins, and like, I've had relatives who've gone through the system, and so this is a fight for everyone. Like, we're not immune to it. Like, this is just like, we're not immune to any of the things that are happening to, you know, the Black community.
She felt that if Hmong Americans could accept that they had experienced very similar amounts of police brutality or treatment at the hands of police as African Americans, they could see that their struggles were actually very similar.
Going back to the conversation with your dad, how did you respond to that sentiment your dad expressed that the movement would only help Black Americans?
I did mention the point to him that I felt very much like this was something that he'd been fighting for his entire life, and this was finally happening. In a lot of ways, his beliefs and views that I've seen my whole life with him really very much align with what's happening with Black Lives Matter. He sat with that and he thought about it. And I think he's really struggling with where to find where he can personally make a contribution.
Will you be supporting it, or are you going to ignore it? Or
I will support it, of course. I'm happy that they're doing something about police brutality. And then we're trying to see, looking at all the mechanisms as to what's been happening. I mean, you know, it's true. I mean, just recently someone got shot again in Atlanta. And it seems to me this is just too endemic. And I think the conversations have started, and that's, I'm happy about that because it's going to benefit everybody.
Did anybody who you talked to talk about moments in our history, including, I'm sure, moments in your dad's history when Asian activists and Black activists worked together on certain causes? I mean, I'm thinking of 50 years ago when Asian and Black groups at San Francisco State worked on behalf of ethnic studies courses and getting more Black people to be part of the college. But did they say anything about that?
Yeah. Russell talked a lot about that and how that movement really did require community leaders to come forward and basically put their individual differences aside and say, we experience racism at the hands of white people, and so we are going to stand together and fight that.
Arms strike, shut it down.
Initiated by the Black Student Union, but joined in by the Third World Liberation Front. They all worked together, recognizing that we're all part of the Third World and that our liberation as individual ethnic and racial groups is dependent on the co-liberation of other groups and with the liberation of African Americans.
We feel that we are united, and we want you to know that we are supporting the demands of the Third World and the Black students at this time.
That's such a powerful moment. I think it's a moment that I hope a lot of Asian people can refer back to when they think about joining together with Black Lives Matter.
Bringing it back to your dad, when you had your second conversation with your dad, how did what you learn then fit into that new understanding or conversation that you had with him?
I think I was maybe more open to hearing about the instances of race that he personally felt, both because I think that it's important to acknowledge those instances and to also tie those instances into how we can get behind the movement. I think initially I was really afraid to hear about the instances with racism that he was going to mention. I think that is a feeling that a lot of Asian Americans feel when they ask their parents about this and their parents say, well, I've experienced racism from Black people too. I think we're really afraid to push a whole lot further because we want to just scream at them it's just one Black person. I think Russell really encouraged me to be more accepting of hearing those stories and also accepting that that can be part of their path towards activism in its own way.
Sarah says she plans to have more conversations with her dad about the Black Lives Matter movement. And her dad plans to reach out to people in his community, his Black friends, his friends at his Buddhist temple, and leaders at Black churches where he lives. And Sarah says he's doing this because he knows the Black Lives Matter movement is important, and he wants to contribute. Sarah Mises-Tan is a reporter with Capital Public Radio covering race and communities of color in Sacramento. This episode was produced by Marisol Medina Cadena and Erica Cruz Cabara. Our editor is Alan Montecilio. I'm Devin Katayama. That's it from the Bay. Talk to you next time.
Gap Radio's Sarah Mises-Tan there in collaboration with KQED. A thank you to KQED's The Bay for letting us air that. And coming up just after the break, Sarah joins us to follow up with some additional perspective, including something known as racial triangulation. This is Gap Radio's special coverage. I'm Randall White. This is Cap Radio special coverage. I'm Randall White, and we just heard reporter Sarah Mises-Tan's interview with The Bay about how Asian Americans find themselves fitting into the Black Lives Matter movement. And we should make one note, and that is that the shooting of Stephon Clark was not the most recent police killing in Sacramento. Daryl Richards was killed by police in September of 2018. Sarah is here with us now, and Sarah, can you explain the model minority a little bit more that you brought up during that episode?
Sure. Thanks so much for having me on, Randall.
Oh, you bet.
So the model minority, I guess, for people who have not heard of this term before, is basically a term that's used to describe a group of people, usually who are grouped by race, where the members are perceived as being able to achieve a higher degree of socioeconomic success than the population average, and they kind of serve as a reference point for other groups. I think most people are familiar with this term as it relates to Asian people. This pretty much describes part of the rhetoric out there around Asian Americans, that we're good at math, for example, that our parents came to this country with nothing and that we went to Harvard, that we work hard, but we don't speak out. Hopefully these are maybe jogging people's memories a little bit.
Right.
Not familiar. And it's this exact stereotype that I think has kept many Asian Americans from really being able to speak out about racism that they've felt in the past. The model minority myth is also one that pits Asian people against Black people very directly. It's used as a tool of reinforcing white supremacy. It basically says, hey, this group of people who aren't white were able to achieve something. Why aren't you Black people? And so there's also that really harmful narrative that runs through it. I think the stereotype also simultaneously silences Asian people, because it rewards us for our silence. For the most part, white people who ascribe to this model minority myth, they find us to be palatable pretty much as long as we don't try to change the system that oppresses us. So it gives us a small fraction of white privilege so that we won't try to dismantle the system. This is exactly what you see playing out in the George Floyd video that I mentioned in the Bay episode, where you see an Asian person aiding a white person who's killing a Black man.
And earlier today, we were talking on the phone and the concept of racial triangulation came up. And I want you to explain that concept a bit for us. And you've spoken with some Asian American scholars who reference this idea when talking about how we can place Asian Americans in racial discourse in this country.
Yeah. I think the whole thing that kind of got me started on this kind of thought process and wanting to kind of talk about this more with my dad was this idea that I felt that a lot of people, both white and Black people, didn't really know where to place me as an Asian American or Asian Americans in general in the spectrum of race. And so racial triangulation is basically a theory that shows privilege in the United States as a graph. It's got an axis of like outsider and insiderness, and it also has a an axis that is privilege based. And I will send you a link so we can hopefully post that to the website for people to see. But essentially, white people are obviously going to be at the very top of this graph, both in terms of insider status within this country and also privilege. Black people are obviously at the very bottom of this graph, but they are still insiders. And so what they mean by that is that if you see a black person walking down the street, most likely you're not going to have a feeling that that black person doesn't belong here, that they're not American.
I see.
However, you know, when it comes to Asian people, I think we kind of land in the middle of that privilege axis, but we are always outsiders. And so, you know, this is something that Russell Zhang talks about. He explains the concept of an insider a little bit. Here he is.
And if you're an insider, you're native born, you're seen as truly belonging to the U.S., and you're seen as a real American. So both whites and blacks are considered real Americans. The other end of the outsider thing, you're considered not really American. For example, I'm fifth generation American, but people will still say, where are you from? As if I don't belong. So in that case, Asians are not the model minority as insiders. We're really perpetual foreigners as the outsiders. We don't belong. We're outside threats. We're the yellow peril.
You know, Sarah, you see this out of Hollywood, too, right? With movies and even television shows like Fresh Off the Boat. I think I got the title of that right. But it's perpetuated that way.
Totally. Yeah. And that's like part of that spectrum of racism that I think that Asian Americans feel, where it's like we benefit partially from the way that white people perceive us in terms of our silence and how they feel that we're easy to deal with because of that silence. But I also think that we are often made the scapegoat. I mean, we saw it very recently with the COVID crisis, and it continues, where Asian people are and have been largely blamed for bringing coronavirus to the United States, even by our own president. And that's a great example of that trope kind of being a double-edged sword, where it's
right.
Like, yes, we will benefit to a certain extent, but we are always foreign and we will always be held up as being an outsider.
Yeah.
When it comes down to it.
Sarah, there's an effort to bring back affirmative action policies at public universities in California. And in order to do that, Proposition 209 needs to be overturned. And that's working its way through the process as we speak. In fact, a few hours ago, the California Senate Appropriations passed Assembly Amendment 5. It now heads to the full Senate for a vote. And if it passes there with a two-thirds majority, as it could, then it will head to California voters in November. Now, according to an article post yesterday in EdSource by reporter Larry Gordon, opponents to this include activists in the Chinese American community who say they fear the measure will lead to a drastic reduction in the number of Asian American students accepted to University of California campuses. How does this then fit into that concept of racial triangulation?
Oh my gosh, I think this is like such a great example of that we're really seeing play out in real time. So overall, I think, again, white supremacy we're seeing has pitted Black people against Asian people, where these two groups feel we have to fight one another in order to win. When really, I think the way I see it is that we need to fight white supremacy together. The affirmative action system is one where a lot of Asians feel shafted because they feel they work really hard, they get good grades, but they aren't chosen in favor of what they would call less qualified Black people. That's the trope anyways. But really what I wanna ask is, why can't we have affirmative action that prioritizes Black people as a result of them having less privileged circumstances, but also allows Asians in if they're qualified? I've seen a lot of graphs, you know, in regards to like Harvard's affirmative action case that depict affirmative action and its impacts, where the white population continues to stay the same and the same system of privilege that allows white people undeserved access remains intact while Asians and Black people are essentially left to fight.
All right, Sarah. This is Cap Radio special coverage. A big thank you again to KQED and the producers of The Bay and Sarah Mises-Tan. This is Capital Public Radio. I'm Randall White.